Well, good morning. It is good to see you and those of you worshiping with us at our other campuses and also online. This is part five of this series on the Bible. Now, what is it? Can it be trusted? And why does it matter? And that second part, can it be trusted? I know when it's time to phone a friend and to have John Dixon step in and carry a couple weeks for us. John, thank you for coming back.
Always a pleasure, man.
Last week, thank you. Apparently, they weren't too brutal last week, so you returned.
Yeah, I passed.
All right, impossible.
You said I could come back and finish it off.
So. All right. Some of John's books, one is called Doubter's Guide to Jesus. One is called Doubter's Guide to the Bible. One is called Doubter's Guide to the Ten Commandments. Do you detect a theme? And last week, John spoke on doubt. And so, John, a question. Why did doubters matter to you?
Well, there are a lot of them. So I kind of like people. So when people come with doubts, I get it. I also came from a home that never had Christianity. So I'd never been to a church before I'd become a Christian, which is very typical in Australia. And so all of my mates were also doubters or skeptics or just had no time for Christianity. And when I became a Christian, I knew they weren't all idiots. So I wanted to listen to why they didn't want to, you know, believe. And have always just had this sympathy, this, you know, kind of relatability to people who don't believe. And I quite like Christians as well, but I especially love reaching out to people who, you know, they think there are good reasons not to believe. I want to puzzle through those questions.
John and I have taken a hike last week on an area hiking trail. And John mentioned to me that as he writes, he's written a bunch of books, in the back of his mind is always a skeptic that is in his life, you know, someone who is not a believer, not a Christian, that he hopes this book gets into their hands. And so a bunch of believers buy John's books. There's always John's hope that someone will be reading, oh, my sister-in-law, this is so, she has to read this. Or Freddie at work, this has got to get into his hands. And so, John, I just want to thank you for devoting yourself to a church ministry and helping believers know that their faith is anchored in something solid, but beyond that, just your heart for people outside the faith in wanting to have a reasonable conversation and present evidence. We're just so grateful for your spending your life in that realm. So with that, will you join me in thanking John for being back with us this weekend?
So last week, as Jeff said, was all about doubting the Bible, and maybe I left a few of you depressed. You'll be happy to know that this week is about trusting the Bible. And, oh, I don't have the screen. Trusting the Bible. Hey! The power in these fingers. And so some of you may be breathing a sigh of relief that we get to the happy bit now. And that does bring us to a wonderful passage that I reflected on last week that reminds us of how solid, how trustworthy our scriptures are. The opening paragraph of Luke's gospel is a wonderful foundation for teaching us the trustworthiness, the solidness of the whole of scripture. Luke, the gospel writer, says, "Many have undertaken to draw up an account of the things that have been fulfilled among us." The life of Jesus fulfills the Old Testament. "Just as they were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself," Luke says, "have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught." And I said last week that this word certainty in Greek is asphaleia, from which we get asphalt, the stuff they make roads out of. And the reason it's asphalt is because you can stand on it. It's solid. And that's the idea that Luke is trying to convey. The stuff that we believe is solid. And today, I want to outline some reasons to trust the Bible, to find it solid. But before I do that, I want to explain to you why I feel a little bit awkward about giving you reasons to trust the Bible. It's important to remember that trusting the Bible is not just a matter of the intellect. And as nerdy as we're going to get in a few minutes, I just really want to offer this caveat. It doesn't come down to the intellect. And it sometimes feels icky to have to give you, you know, the 7 reasons to trust the Bible. It feels a bit like having to give a talk about the reasons you should trust my wife is faithful, not unfaithful. I'd hate to do that. Because her faithfulness is not a matter of, you know, me being able to give you the 13 pieces of evidence for her faithfulness. I feel like just saying, just get to know her. And you'll realize how silly it is to begin from a position of distrust. It isn't about individual pieces of evidence. It's about a whole pattern of trustworthiness. And I feel it's like that with the Bible. It isn't just about evidence I can present, even though there is that evidence. It's about a whole pattern of trustworthiness. And so I feel like saying it's really important to understand that although I'm going to give you reasons to trust the Bible, the best way to learn how solid the Bible is to get to know it like a friend, like a lover. And you'll see the pattern of faithfulness. And the other thing, of course, that has to be said is that intelligence is not always the path to truth. I sometimes have skeptical people say to me, did you know that atheists tend to have higher intelligence than believers? And yes, I did, because I've read this journal article from 2009 in a really important peer-reviewed journal, and that it demonstrated, on average, atheists have higher IQs than religious people. Okay? And it's often put to me that, you know, I'm smart. I don't need your faith. Now, they overlook a really important point, because the same peer-reviewed studies find something that's really worth remembering if you happen to be a high IQ person. Jonathan Haidt is a professor at New York University. He's an atheist. He's a professor of social evolutionary psychology, and he's written this incredibly well-known book where he outlines the peer-reviewed research that indicates people with high IQs aren't necessarily better at ascertaining true beliefs, but they are better at rationalizing existing beliefs. People who have a high intelligence can find more arguments for what they already believe. They aren't necessarily better at arriving at true beliefs. And this is why you sometimes, when you talk with high IQ people, you know they're wrong about something, but you can't beat them in an argument. Because their superpower isn't arriving at their truth. Their superpower is being able to out-argue you. And what's more, out-argue themselves. They justify their own beliefs to themselves. High intelligence allows you to rationalize your own beliefs to yourself. So maybe atheists are just so smart, they're able to convince themselves there's no God. But actually, I wouldn't say that. That'd be a little impolite. But also, there's a caveat in this original study that found that on average, atheists have higher IQs than religious people. That's true, but you know, in the same study, they broke out the cohorts, separated them out, and they found that the people with the highest on average IQs are actually Jews and Anglicans. Higher than the atheists even. Now, part of me likes this because I'm an Anglican. But actually, I'm not going to make an argument along those lines, because maybe all that means is I'm better at fooling myself. Because high intelligence isn't the path to truth. It's the path to being able to argue yourself into your own position and out-argue other people. My point is, it doesn't come down to intelligence, friends. Intelligence can actually be a hindrance to the truth. Because if you want to get out of something that's obvious, the better, more intelligent you are, the more paths away you'll be able to find. Beware. And of course, to repeat the point, learning to trust the Bible isn't a matter of evidence, even though there is that evidence. You've got to get to know the Bible, and you'll see the pattern of trustworthiness, like getting to know a a friend. All right, with those caveats in place, let me now contradict myself completely by giving you some intellectual reasons to trust the Bible. But please don't forget that first caveat. One question that is often raised as soon as we start to talk about the trustworthiness of the Bible is, how do we get the texts that we've got in the Bible? I mean, here I am talking about the Gospel of Luke, all right? And I'm founding my talk on the Gospel of Luke, but why not the Gospel of Thomas? The Gnostic Gospel of Thomas, which I got to play with in a museum in Egypt some years ago. Why Luke, not Thomas? Aha, right? Some of you asked this question. So for example, Leah, a member of your church, asked, when the Bible says on more than one occasion, do not add or take away from, how can we be confident that the right books are there? Excellent. Dave also asked the similar question. When the books of the Bible were chosen, why were some omitted? I like this question, but it is a massive question that deserves well over an hour to give you the details. And for the 11 people watching or here in the room who want the full hour, I did do a podcast on it. Just search in your podcasts for Canon Fodder and you'll get the whole hour. Actually, maybe 13, because I met people at the previous service, two of them, who said, we'll watch it as well. We'll listen to it as well. So, but here is just the 5-minute version, if that's okay, not the hour and 5-minute version. Right, big thumbs up down the bottom here. One common misperception about how the Bible came together is that it is all the fault of this bloke, Constantine, in the 4th century, 300 years after Jesus. Constantine, the first Christian emperor, he decided to commission some books and burn other books, and that's how we got the Bible. Constantine, the emperor, decided what went into the Bible. You hear it so often, especially since this book came out, Dan Brown's The Da Vinci Code. It sold 82 million copies, this book. The jerk. And so many people... Sorry, did I say that or just think it? So many people I meet think it because that's what the novel, The Da Vinci Code, says. Constantine commissioned some books and burned other books. We in historical scholarship have a technical piece of jargon language we use for claims like this. We call it completely nuts, all right? Completely nuts. Because we know beyond doubting that isn't true. It's impossible. Because we can prove that Christians from the beginning were citing and preaching from the books of the Bible centuries before Constantine. There is no way Constantine had anything to do with the books in the Bible. And the reasoning of the early Christians was not politics. It was not power. They just wanted to hear the voice of the apostles because they knew Jesus appointed apostles to speak on his behalf. And when you hear an ambassador, you're hearing the president. And so they wanted to hear the ambassador's voice. So they basically trusted texts written by an apostle or an appointee. Here's the fact. From as early as the first century, Christians were asking this question. Which texts outlining the faith are widely known to have been written by an apostle or an appointee of an apostle? So the writings of John, of Paul, of Peter were easily revered because they were by apostles. The writings of Luke, which is the Gospel of Luke in the book of Acts, or the writings of Mark, the Gospel of Mark, they weren't eyewitnesses, they weren't apostles, but they were clearly appointees of apostles. And so they revered these texts from the beginning. Now, it's true to say there was some doubt on the edges about some books that maybe you haven't heard of, like the Epistle of Barnabas. The Epistle of Barnabas, historically speaking, almost got into the New Testament. And you go, what? It's because the early church had this epistle that was titled of Barnabas, and they loved it because actually it's an awesome epistle, right? Great, right? And they worried that it was actually from the Barnabas in the New Testament, you know, the colleague of Paul. Barnabas is an important figure. And so they read it. But some other Christians didn't have that letter and weren't sure it was by Barnabas and so didn't have it. In fact, we have this funny little thing in the earliest copy of the complete Bible from the middle of the 300s AD. The Epistle of Barnabas is in the Bible, but at the back as an appendix, which is really interesting because it's not next to the other epistles, but at the back as an appendix, which tells us that the earliest Christians loved it, weren't 100% sure it was really by Barnabas, but didn't want to chuck it out just in case, okay? Now, eventually the Christians came to believe it's probably not by the Barnabas that we know from the New Testament, not an appointee of an apostle, so let's leave it to one side. And the cool thing is, they were exactly right to do so. Because every scholar today knows the Epistle of Barnabas was not written in the first century by Barnabas. The early Christians got it bang on right. And it's the same with the Gospel of Thomas, by the way, that I mentioned earlier. We know that wasn't written by Thomas. We know it was from the second century, not the first century. And so the Christians were right to just leave it to one side. Now, they didn't burn this material. They didn't ban it even. I have all of this material on my bookshelf at home. Some of it's fantastic to read. Some of it's a little bit wacky. But the Christians did us proud. In fact, I like to point out that if historians today set out to discover a list of ancient texts written by an apostle or appointee of an apostle, they would come up with the same 27 books we have in our New Testament. Friends, we have the right books. To hear the voice of the apostle, we have the right books. But there's another question that immediately springs to mind. How do we know the manuscript copies have been accurately preserved? Okay, John, maybe we do have the right books, but how do we know those books have been copied accurately? All right? Over so many centuries of copying and copying and copying, maybe changes have taken place. One of you guys, called Jay, asked this exact question when we collated questions for this series. How can we know that everything written in the Bible is the way that it's supposed to be written after years and years of copying and translating before the printing press? It's a great question, but here is the fact worth remembering. The New Testament is the best attested text of classical history. That's not just an exaggeration a pastor can get away with in a church. I could say this sentence in the classics faculty of Oxford University and no one would raise an eyebrow because everyone knows the New Testament is the best attested text of all of the classical texts that we have from ancient Greece and ancient Rome. And I want to give you a really fair comparison so you can just see why even secular scholars agree with this fact. Here is a text you may or may not have heard of. If you've done any ancient history or classical studies, you will have heard of Virgil's Aeneid. It's an epic poem about the founding of Rome. And it's one of the most important texts. In the first century, one of the most popular and loved texts. And that's why it's one of Rome's best attested texts. That is, it has been copied over and over and over. And we can be very confident we know what Virgil wrote in his book, The Aeneid. We have three complete manuscripts from the ancient world. We have seven substantial manuscripts. When I say substantial, don't think a few pages. Think 80 pages, okay? And we have seven of them and 20 fragments. That's a fragment is like a piece of paper written on back and front. But when you have three complete manuscripts, seven substantial and 20 fragments, it's really easy to line them all up as scholars do and go word by word by word by word and work out where the variations have taken place. And with that many manuscripts, you can pretty much work out what Virgil originally wrote. Even if there are differences between manuscripts, it's easy to weed them out if you have lots of manuscripts. So, how does it compare to the New Testament? Thank you for asking. Here are the facts about the New Testament. We have 60 complete manuscripts of the New Testament. We have 340 substantial manuscripts. Again, one of these substantial manuscripts might contain 70 or 80 pages of Paul's letters, but that would just be called one of the 340 substantial. And then when we start to include fragments, single pages written back and front of the New Testament, as occasionally pop up, we have more than 4,000 of these. And when you have that many copies, you can easily find where some scribe was writing late at night and nodded off and missed a couple of lines and just kept writing. And it literally happens. We literally have, you know, a copy of Paul's letters and it's just beautifully copied out, and then a whole line or two are missing. And you go, what? But because you have so many others, you know that the scribe must have fallen asleep or had some of that medieval beer. I got to play with the earliest copy of Paul's letters at the University of Michigan last time I was here. Did you know your university down the road has the oldest copy of Paul's letters? About 70 or 80 pages of them? Amazing. So when I was here, I zoomed over, spoke to Brendan Howe, the curator of the manuscript collection. And he actually, after I played with all these Pauline letters, and I was leaving, he said, oh, you know, tell your friends who live around here, they're allowed to come to the manuscript center and have a look at these. So here's the invitation. Go and have a look at them. You can hold Paul's letters in your hands. You have to go through a vault into another vault into another vault to do it. So it's not like you can go, see you later, right? My point is, we have so many copies. We can work out where the mistakes and variations have taken place. And when we print a modern Bible, we take all of that into account. You can be more confident that what you read today in the New Testament is an accurate rendition of what was originally written than you can for any other ancient text you'll ever pick up in your hand. All right, we've got the right books. We know the books have been accurately preserved through the copying process. But there's another historical question. How close in time were our texts written? Okay, because it's one thing to say, oh yeah, we've got the good books. They've been well preserved. But what if they were written hundreds of years after Jesus, as sometimes people claim? Certainly the Da Vinci Code claimed that, and people just believed it, that maybe Constantine wrote some of the books or got scholars in his day to write some of the books. That would be 300 years later, and that would be a problem. But in the case of the New Testament, actually, it's no problem. Luke himself hints at the early date of his own writing. And look at the words, they're really interesting. These things about Jesus were handed down to us by those who from the first were eyewitnesses and servants of the word. With this in mind, since I myself have carefully investigated everything from the beginning, I too decided to write. Now what's so fascinating is he admits he himself is not an eyewitness, but has received the material from the eyewitnesses. Isn't that interesting? Think of this skeptically. If he were making this up, if these Gospels were made up, why didn't he just claim to be an eyewitness? Who would find him out if it's made up? It's truth-telling right here to say, oh, I'm not an eyewitness, but I received it from the eyewitnesses. And he says he received from the eyewitnesses and that he's investigated everything from the beginning, which means he's very close in time to the events. And we know how close in time Luke was to the events, because we can place him, we can verify when Luke came into contact with the eyewitnesses, and it's the mid-40s AD, within about 15 or so years of Jesus himself. He is with the eyewitnesses. That is, in ancient history terms, so close. Even if he didn't write his gospel until the 70s, so 40 or so years after Jesus, which many scholars think, we know his information comes from this very early period. Now, let me give you again fair comparison with the sort of things historians deal with for other really important figures of the past. All right, Alexander the Great, who ruled the world 300 or so years before Jesus. Did you know our first biographical source for his life was written by Polybius 120 years after Alexander died? 120 years. Emperor Tiberius, Who is the emperor when Jesus lived? He's the emperor, if you remember from last week, on the denarius, the coin that I wear around my neck. Did you know our very best source is Tacitus, the great Roman chronicler? He wrote 80 years after Tiberius has died. That is normal. This is still regarded as good evidence. In the case of the New Testament, friends, we have documents from within 20 years of Jesus and all of the documents within 60. So even the latest text in the New Testament is closer in time to Jesus than the best text we have for the emperor of the same time. The fact is this: all the New Testament texts were written within living memory of Jesus. And that is the thing worth remembering. Even when the last text was being written, there were people alive who had known Jesus. That's so different from Tacitus, who writes when no one actually personally could remember Tiberius. Our New Testament texts are written within living memory. This makes our New Testament, in ancient history terms, a very special text. And there's one final question that I think reveals just how special our scriptures are. The question is this: how do we know the Bible isn't just another text of power politics? Maybe you've thought of this, maybe you haven't. But a frequent criticism of all history writings and the Bible is that it was written by elites, the powerful. And of course, the powerful get to write the history. You know, the winners write the history, right? You often hear that expression. And people say that's true of the Bible. Now, it is true that many of our ancient sources were written by elites. Virgil was an elite Roman. Philo of Alexandria, an elite. Tacitus, elite. Philostratus, Pliny, Josephus, they are all elites. Powerful people. And the problem with having so many elite sources when you're trying to work out what's the truth about ancient times is you're not sure you can completely trust it, because on the one hand, you're not sure you're hearing about the great mass of people. You're just hearing an elite perspective. And you're even more worried that the writing itself is a form of manipulation. The elite's trying to keep control over people. And people say that's true of the Bible too. They say it was written by the powerful to control the masses. And that is false. Verifiably so. The fact is, most of the Old Testament and all of the New Testament were written by those without power. And I think this matters, and I'll explain why it matters in a moment. Now, in the case of the Old Testament, yes, some texts we know were written by elites. So like Psalms, Proverbs, Song of Songs. It's clear they are written by elite, powerful people. But most scholars agree the bulk of the Old Testament was written, or at least pulled together, when Israel was completely out of power, when they were exiles. So the text itself isn't a power text. But however true that is of the Old Testament, it is infinitely more true of the New Testament. Was not written by the powerful. Luke, in the front of his gospel, even indicates he doesn't share elite status. Did you notice he says, I too decided to write an orderly account for you, most excellent Theophilus, so that you may know the certainty of the things you have been taught. He addresses Theophilus, who was probably a local official or maybe a benefactor of higher status. And he dedicates the volume to this Theophilus. But the crucial thing to notice is that he calls him most excellent. And the precise language that's used there is the language of someone of higher status than Luke. And the thing is, Luke doesn't have that status. He has to talk up. Now, Luke is no dummy. I'm not saying Luke is this sort of pauper, you know, who never finished school. His Greek is actually really good Greek. Okay, he's got a big, wide vocabulary, really nice grammar. So he's educated, but he doesn't share the status of Theophilus. And he writes not in literary Greek. He writes in common Greek, what's called Koine Greek. It's the Greek you go and you order your lamb souvlaki with down at the marketplace. It's that Greek. It's commoner Greek. And in fact, we know that elites in the second and third centuries who came across the Bible actually thought it was so lower class because it's not written in the pretty language they were used to. Why is any of this worth knowing? Well, because the New Testament provides a rare example of history from below. Yes, most ancient writings are elite power writings, not the New Testament. The language is common. All the manuscripts that we have from the early period are in non-elite handwriting. I mean, I don't know how well you can see this handwriting. Even I can write that well in Greek. This is not professional handwriting. And the story it tells is not about the elites. It's about fishermen and carpenters and so on. I interviewed Teresa Morgan, who is a professor of Greco-Roman history at the University of Oxford, one of the leading classical scholars and experts in early Christianity in the world today. And happily for America, Yale University just poached her from Oxford. Those jerks at Yale. But I got to interview her when she was at Oxford. And she just in passing, she mentioned this very point about the New Testament. Have a listen.
So this really is the community literature of very ordinary people. And as such, it's actually a priceless, I mean, aside from its religious value, it's a priceless document in social history of the lives of a community of really pretty ordinary people in the early Roman Empire, of a kind that we have almost no parallel for. I mean, it's a very rare corpus of documents just for a social historian.
We have almost no parallel. Now, this is a woman who is expert in all of the literature of the time. And she says, we have almost nothing like the New Testament. The writings of ordinary people. History from below. I mean, the writings are not the writings of bullies. I know the church has been a bully through history. It's possible some people watching have been the victim of bully church. But the thing is, the writings themselves are not about manipulation and control. They are from below. And after all, they tell a story from below as well. If we turn over the page in Luke's gospel, we get the manger story. Now, that's not just a pretty Christmas story that makes us feel warm and fuzzy. This is saying that the Lord of the universe entered into the world and there was no room, a normal room, for this Lord. So he had to be laid in a manger, which is an animal feeding area. And then this boy grows up into a man and he teaches humbly. He welcomes sinners to his table. He touches lepers. And eventually he gives himself on a cross for our salvation, bearing into himself our sin and judgment. This is a story from below about the God who came low for us. So in a weird way, Christianity is both solid and soft. It's solid in the sense that it's true. True. Like if you bump into it, it's not moving. You can throw your most skeptical question at it and it'll just smile sweetly back at you, immovable. But it is also soft in that it's not the truth of the bully to control you. It's the truth of the Lord who emptied himself and gave himself for us. This is a trustworthy text. And when you discover how solid and soft this gospel, this Bible is, it changes everything. One of the most dear and surprising friendships of my life was with this woman, Marie Rose Graber. Marie was a French atheist. If you know anything about atheism, you'll know the French do it best. They do it with flair, with panache, with disdain and snobbery. And she was one of those. And when she was in Paris at university in the 50s, which is sort of the height of existential atheism, she read all of the philosophers in the multiple languages she was fluent in. David Hume, René Descartes, Immanuel Kant, Friedrich Nietzsche, Albert Camus, Jean-Paul Sartre. And she gobbled them all up and was confirmed in her atheism. But years later, she took a post at Sydney University as an academic there and taught there happily, continuing her French atheism with all that beautiful disdain. And then she met a member of my church one day at a language school. And they got talking about religion. And Marie was always interested in talking about religious things, even though she thought they were sort of beneath her. And this member of my church, who himself was not sure about the faith, but he came to our church nonetheless, lent Marie a book. Said, here, read this Christian book, see what you think. Marie took it, you know, didn't have enough pages in it to be taken seriously, but she took it and she read it. And then she met with Peter again and said, I will have another of those, please. And he said, well, you can go to the Christian bookshop and you can go and get a book on any topic you like. So Marie took herself out to Coorong Books, this famous bookshop in Australia, Christian bookshop, and she went through all the different sections. And I just wish I'd been a fly on the wall for that, because the shop attendants would not have known the brain that was in the store. And she just went through and she was, I'll have that, I will have that, I will have that. And she bought them and she devoured them. Enough to think maybe there's something in this after all. So she asked if she could come to church. She came to church. And that's when I met her. I happened to be preaching that day. At the end of it, she demanded an audience with me. And so began years of delightful conversation and emails backwards and forwards and dinners at our place and Bible studies and church services. And slowly, slowly, she asked her questions. Some of them were intellectual questions, like the questions we've looked at today. She was a French atheist and she was going to apply her mind. She also had questions about power and politics of the church, because the French are very suspicious about the church and its power through history. And over time, she was reading the Gospels as well. And I'll never forget one evening, she shot me an email to tell me she was beginning to change her mind about the Gospels. Reading the story of Jesus began to change her. This is what she wrote to me in June. Dear Buff and John, I should tell you, my wife is called Buff, which I know has a different meaning here in America, but when I first introduced Marie to Buff, she went, Biff? It's a disgusting name. All right, she'd gotten over that by this time. Dear Biff and John, I find it incredible, she's talking about reading the Gospels, that walking on the dusty roads of Palestine, under the hot sun, with a bunch of uneducated people, she was such a snob to the end, should give me such pleasure and make me look at life so differently. In my life, I have read avidly all sorts of books, and I never thought that the Gospels could stimulate thus my brain and give me at the same time the feeling that I had arrived to the most important discovery, to the only worthwhile discovery of my life. My love to you all, Marie. That was June. In October, the following year, because she just took her time through this whole process, she had come to believe in Christ and come to realize grace. And one night she shot me another email the following October in which she said this: "Dear John and Buff, it is a miracle for me to learn that God had forgiven me all my past sins. What joy I experienced in Christianity. But later, when I observed I was indulging in the same sins again, I had moments of doubts. Would God continue to forgive me? Then, by praying to tell God how sorry I was, the joy came back. It was as if God had forgiven me my past and present and perhaps future sins. This is probably not orthodox, but somehow I still believe it. Much love to you all, Marie." And I can remember jumping online and instantly replying to her, "Marie, that is orthodox. That's what we say. Jesus died for your past, present, and yes, your future sins. That sense of forgiveness that covers the whole of your life, that is the Christian faith." And Marie came through to this beautiful trust in Jesus Christ. To the very end, her last 6 months riddled with cancer were no fun, but I got to visit her in hospital, as you can see there, many times, and she eventually died. This is her grave with her favorite passage of the Bible printed. A grave I visit every year, take my kids, take her a cappuccino with two sugars, which I always used to do. But I think of Marie, and I'm reminded that here is someone who found satisfaction for their intellect, but also reassurance for their soul about the love of God. She found something solid for her big brain and something soft for her suspicious, distrusting soul. She found the mercy of God. And just last year, I was preaching in another church in Australia, and I told the story of Marie, just like I've told you now. Except halfway through the story, there's this man who's sitting about where you are, sir, and I'm telling the story, and he's like crying. And I was like, "Oh, what have I done? You know, maybe his auntie or grandma's dying, and I've just provoked this whole thing." And I was a bit distracted by it. And afterwards, he came straight up to me after the sermon, came down the front, tears falling down his face. And he said, "I was Marie's student at Sydney University for years. She was my supervisor for my master's. I spent hours in her office. John, she was the last person I ever thought could become a Christian. That mind, that distrust, I can't believe it. Thank you for telling us that story." And I wept. Here's the thing. From Theophilus in the first century to Marie in the 21st century, people who really give themselves to look at this, they will find something for the mind, yes, and something for the soul. There are answers to your intellectual questions, but there is mercy and grace and the love of God in this gospel. You will find something solid and something soft. So, Lord, please, will you help us wherever we are in our journey of doubt or faith. Help us, Lord, to find answers to our difficult questions. But Lord, I want to pray for people here or watching online. Please help them to see not just how solid the Bible is, but how soft, gracious, and loving you are. That in Jesus Christ we find the humble Lord who wishes us good, who gave himself for us. Oh Lord, I pray that you lead us all to trust. For we ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.
John, our sincerest thanks. I'm deeply grateful for John's devotion to scholarship. That John takes the time to read through manuscripts and volumes that would bore most of us to tears, gleaning through those and just bringing it down to a practical level that most of us can enjoy, understand, and appreciate. So I enjoy John's devotion to scholarship. I also enjoy John's devotion to people, to us. This is like year 10 that John has been with us. Busy schedule and speaking and writing and a podcast that he does now. And yet, John, we just want to thank you for just taking your time to be with us and sharing your heart with us. John, thank you. Thank you for being solid and for being soft. Let's thank John one more time, can we? Here. So hey, you're gonna move into your week. You got school, you've got work, you've got family, probably unspeakable joy and conflict, decisions to navigate. May our gracious God carry you through your week. May he give you joy, may he give you wisdom, may he give you insight as you love and as you serve. We'll see you next week.